But first, some Detroit City Council officials have formally appealed the determination that their city is in a financial emergency. That designation is part of the ramp-up to a takeover by an emergency financial manager. City Council reps argued their case to Chief Deputy Treasurer Mary McDowell this morning. Here's Detroit City Council President Charles Pugh right after the hearing.
The emergency manager is not a foregone conclusion, and it's not the only option.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief of the Michigan Public Radio Network, was at the hearing today. So, Rick, is there any sense that this appeal will change the governor's mind about appointing an emergency manager for Detroit?
I don't think that anyone really expects that this will change anything, in part because, you know, one of the big arguments that the State Treasury Department made is that a lot of the city's presentation was about what it could do going forward, that the state could come in and renegotiate a new consent agreement with sort of a mini emergency manager in it, a what's called a program manager with a lot more authority than even the one right now, in lieu of the drastic and dramatic action of naming an emergency manager to run the city. And what the Treasury is saying is that everything that the city has done has been too little too late, and the governor legally can't even look into the future as to what the city might promise to do.
So Detroit Mayor Dave Bing has decided he's not participating in this appeal. So I'm wondering, what is the message there? What's it reveal about the process?
There's a real division among Detroit's politicians, that some are saying that the city needs to fight emergency management to its last breath to demand things from the state that the state has not been forthcoming with yet. And other people are saying, you know what, it's the die is cast. We know that the governor is going to name an emergency manager, and now is the time, whether we like it or not, to work on cooperation rather than on confrontation in terms of what's going to happen next with the city of Detroit.
So what are the specific arguments that the state is coming up with that an emergency financial manager is needed?
The big ones are that the city has failed to meet many of the terms in the consent agreement that the state and the city inked last spring, that just lots of benchmarks have gone by and they've been unfulfilled, that the city's financial picture just grows increasingly worse over time, you know, without these things happening, and maybe even with them happening, and that only an emergency manager would have the authority to go in and fix them. And then finally, just sort of in the broader sense, is the city can, you know, make whatever promises and assurances regarding what might happen as things move ahead. But this process is really backward-looking. Has the city done what it said it's going to do? It's not forward-looking. Can the city do something more to avert this?
Or will it? So we've been seeing
some
small protests in Detroit about the idea of an emergency financial manager coming in. I'm wondering about this hearing. Were the protesters there? What was the atmosphere like? Where was the hearing held?
Well, it was held in the State Treasury building. It's part of the complex of buildings that surround the state capitol in downtown Lansing. And there were a handful of protesters on hand. There was actually signs posted in the front of the Treasury building warning them that their signs were not allowed inside. But really, nothing big, nothing terribly dramatic, you know, not a lot of people chanting like, I was here years and years and years ago when the Detroit School District was first taken over when John Engler was the governor. And, you know, the halls of the Capitol were filled with protesters during that process. So this was just a lot quieter and really almost an atmosphere of acceptance. The room, the actual hearing room, is very, you know, sterile, metal walls, small. It was hard to fit in everyone who wanted to be there. And so, you know, really very unassuming overall.
So we've got the designation. There's a declared emergency. We've had this appeal.
And the city never argued that there was not an emergency. I should point that out. They agree there's an emergency. It's just how to tackle it, whether the city has been a cooperative partner, and what might be done going forward. Those were the, you know, those were the areas of disagreement.
So what's the next step in this process? Is it the governor coming in with a name?
The governor will let it be known what he's decided to do, and the expectation is still that he will name an emergency manager. There is nothing stopping the city or the city council from challenging that in court if they decide to do that. As a matter of fact, it's widely expected. It was one of the arguments that the representatives of the city council made, that if you go ahead with the consent agreement or a renegotiated consent agreement, that's been litigated. The capacity of the state to impose this on the city, that's been litigated. The new emergency manager, under the new emergency manager law and the state's authority to put that person in place, that has not been litigated. And if this does go to court, that could slow this down.
So it was reported this morning that Governor Snyder might have someone in mind for this emergency manager for Detroit, a guy named Kevin Orr. Who is he? What do we know about him? And have we had any confirmation from the governor's office?
I have not been able to independently confirm that it's Kevin Orr. We know that he's an attorney with a very respected Washington, D.C. law firm that worked on the Chrysler bailout. And so he's a graduate, a double graduate of the University of Michigan. So he has ties to the state. And he does seem to, on paper at least, meet the criteria that the governor said he had for whomever he might name as an emergency manager, which is large organization turnaround skills. That would be Chrysler plus some other projects that apparently Mr. Orr has worked on. That he's a communicator, that and he is apparently a frequent lecturer. He testifies before Congress, and so that would seem to fit the model of being of having some communication skills, and in this case, to sell it to the city. And also just some financial expertise, and that does seem to be what Mr. Orr does.
We keep hearing from the governor's office, we're going to hear something soon. What does soon mean? How soon is now?
We are expecting the announcement within days that, you know, now that, that this last technical part of the process of the emergency management process, the state takeover process is complete, that, you know, the governor will, you know, make sure to, you know, if not do his due diligence, at least, you know, let it be known that he's done his due diligence, make it appear that he's done his due diligence, and then name you know, the emergency manager, that there's nothing to be gained from waiting on this decision. He did say that the hearing officer did say that the state will continue to take comments on this until 5 o'clock today.
So assuming the governor does go ahead and appoint this emergency financial manager, suddenly Detroit is Rick Snyder's problem, and it's a big problem, and Rick Snyder has a reelection campaign coming up. I wonder how people will view that if something doesn't happen quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. There may be an emergency manager running the city of Detroit with the responsibility of solving those problems, but those problems, they are now owned by Rick Snyder once he does pull the trigger on a state takeover. It is going to be the success or failure of a state takeover of the city of Detroit will be one of the key things that he's judged on when he seeks re-election next year, you know, right up with, you know, well, the state's unemployment rate, to name one.
Well, this is something that is not going to be fixed in a few weeks, a few months, and not even in a few years. This is going to be a...
Well, the expectation is that the job of the turnaround person, the emergency manager, is going to take 18 months. And then, you know, there's everything that goes out beyond that.
I guess the question I'm having is this going to be, if we don't see some kind of quick, dramatic action that is positive for Detroit, is this going to affect Rick Snyder's chances at reelection?
Yes, absolutely. That you know, a year from now, that the governor is going to have to show some discernible process or some. The governor is going to have to be able to show some discernible progress, some measurable progress, if he's going to make the case that a state takeover of Detroit was the right thing to do.
Okay. Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks very much, Rick.
My pleasure, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The State Department of Natural Resources has been in the planning process of this idea to create what they call biodiversity stewardship areas. Early in the process, all the stakeholders were on board, the hunting groups, the environmentalists, almost everyone, until someone became alarmed because the plan could have potentially stopped human access to some areas. Well, if you even hint that hunters or timber companies can't have access to natural areas in this state, you've got a problem. Senator Tom Casperson, a Republican from Escanaba, introduced a bill that would prohibit the Department of Natural Resources from setting aside an area of land specifically for the purpose of maintaining biological diversity. Senator Casperson joins us now. So am I reading this right? Would this bill stop the DNR from setting aside any land for the sake of biological restoration?
That's not how I read it. I read it that they can do it, but they have to go to the legislature to get approval in this particular case. And that
for
was based
each
on
case?
What they, yeah, based on what they originally had proposed was the purpose or the reason behind what we're doing here. It's not they can't do it. It's that we think it needs to have some oversight, not just simply a signature from the director saying we're going to do it.
Now, environmentalists have told me there's a way legislation could accomplish what you want, access to the land for hunters, without barring the DNR from protecting biodiversity. So why is this bill written so broadly and takes so much authority away from the DNR?
When I look at what they have right now at their disposal, they have a huge amount of tools, and I call them tools in the toolbox, to do exactly what most folks are talking about, whether it be set-asides or using it for recreational or just about anything imaginable that they want to do with the land. The biodiversity stewardship areas is designed to, we believe, carve out large areas of land dedicated for the purpose of biodiversity, but that doesn't stop there because we also believe that its biodiversity for a particular area would be under the interpretation of who's ever in charge at the time within the department of what that means, because biodiversity can mean different things to different parts of the land. And so we think there should be more oversight for that decision to be made because it seems like it's dependent upon who's in charge that gets to do that. And we have a concern with that, especially when you look at what they already have. A lot of the argument was against this was made, I believe, to almost come across like if they don't have this specific ability or terminology or however you want to put it, that they're done. They can't do anything to protect biodiversity. And I don't believe that to be true, not with 22 different tools in the toolbox to do exactly that.
But don't we have a department like this full of experts that we hire as a state to manage the land in a way that's appropriate rather than having the legislature micromanage how they do it?
Yeah, except that I would agree, and that's why I think they have a duty to come and present it to the legislature to make this big of a move, because when you say that they're the experts, or you're suggesting they're the experts and we should let them do it without micromanaging them, then I get back to what was stated in 2009 over this biodiversity issue, when it appeared to me, based on what I read, that the Sierra Club was heavily involved in actually driving this issue. In fact, the statements by Marv Robertson were that this was something they worked on for 20 years to get this done, and finally got it done, and he cited the reason they got it done was because leadership changed within the department, and that leadership was like-minded and favorable to their cause. And so I don't think it's appropriate that one group should be able to drive that type of a policy. They certainly should be at the table and should have input, but they shouldn't be driving it.
So what are the benefits here? What are we gaining out of this situation if the DNR cannot have this tool in their toolbox?
Well, what we're gaining is oversight. If you look at the original, and by the way, there was some environmental groups that put letters on my desk that conceded that what started this, what got us involved, the original proposal out of the gate, the one that Marv Roberson from the Sierra Club supported wholeheartedly, might have gone too far, and that's their words. And the fact that they dedicated 200,000 acres of private land into this without notifying the private landowners, that's what would have happened, that was an overreach and it shouldn't have happened, and that then they disagree with me, the approach I'm taking to, you know, deal with that. Well, the question really is, if they agree that it's an overreach, then why were they at the table putting that overreach in to start with? And that's where the concerns come in, because the very groups that have now conceded it might have been an overreach were the very groups that were putting it in to this plan when there was going to be no legislative oversight. It's simply going to be a signature by the director, which would have been an order, and it would have been imposed or implemented.
Have you had a conversation with the director? What does he think of this?
he agrees with me on the overreach. The problem is that I think the department has is the separations of power. They're concerned about the legislature dictating what the director can and can't do with these type of things.
Exactly, because he's to answer to the governor.
Right, exactly. So that's where we're probably at odds to a degree. But the substance of what we're talking about, he too is concerned about. I think between the department and ourselves, we're going to try and find a way to maybe balance this out. But there was clearly, in many people's eyes, a clear overreach by our department. And that had it not been for legislators enacting or getting involved, the director was going to sign that order. And that was 700,000 acres of land with 200,000 acres of it being private. And all we're simply saying is, if that's where the department was heading, that to us appeared to be a clear overreach. And how do we get to the point that we have a discussion publicly about this? And that's what we're trying to do.
Tom Casperson is Senator from Escanaba and the Upper Peninsula. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Hey, thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Anybody who knows me would be shocked, I tell you, to learn that I like to visit bars.
Here's your drink, Mr. Graham.
Thanks, Allie. Michigan beer. Well, a couple of guys, a father and some team, have been doing the kind of research I dream about, visiting more than 100 bars in the Upper Peninsula for a travel guide entitled Upper Bars. Joining me now are father Randy Cluck and son Kevin Cluck. Tough job, guys. I suppose somebody had to do it, though.
That somebody had to be us. Mike Rowe is probably pretty envious. He didn't get a crack at it.
Now, I read you guys visited 110 bars out of the 300 in the UP. How'd you decide which ones to visit, which ones made it into the travel guide?
Oh, we drew straws. I visited all 300, just scouting out. We wanted to present maybe 110 of the most robust bars that somebody would really relish driving up from Grand Rapids to Lansing and spending a long weekend. The bars that have great food, great ambiance, and that's what really got to us is you and I could walk in some of these bars as perfect strangers, and within 15 minutes you'd think you're at a family reunion. It's just really cool, and just had to pick 110 out of the 300.
Well, I admire your perseverance for visiting all 300. That's So where'd you guys start your tour?
We like to use the analogy of Lewis and Clark. We started in the east, and we ended up working our way west. Started in the Sioux, and we finished up all the way over there in Iron River.
It started out kind of fun and cutesy because we did the bars in the eastern UP. I think there's eight of them in Sault Ste. Marie alone. So it was pretty easy on a weekend just to walk a couple blocks and do a profile. But then it ended up being extremely hard work. You'd wake up and have to be over in Copper Harbor or Crystal Falls. And over an eight-month period, we put 47,000 miles on our vehicle back and forth.
I can imagine. And all the sampling and the food and the drinks you'd have to do, that must have been tough on you guys.
There's just so much. The giant burgers, the pasties, the all-you-can-eat fish fries, the prime rib dinner on Saturday over in Cook's. Ended up saying no quite a bit. First thing that you'd walk in and do a profile, hey, Randy, hey, try this. Hey, Kevin, have some of that. And, oh, geez, after, 8 months and 30 pounds later. But it was a lot of fun. And we feel like the UP is as cool a place as anywhere in North America to spend a long weekend or a week. And the bars are just one aspect of the UP ambiance, and that's what we decided to present. And getting a lot of people up here for maybe the first time in their lives.
Yeah, the guide is really interesting. It gives a little bit of the history of each of the bars, a little bit of the flavor, the local specialty drink, a bit about the food, the atmosphere, the staff, some fun folks, the local favorite joke, which I got a kick out of, unique UP humor there. There's a lot of humor in the guide, in fact. How'd you decide to include all of that? I mean, I wouldn't have thought to ask about the local joke or the some of the other things you guys included.
Well, our vision was your listeners get their hands on this book, and before they even pull out of their driveway, they know exactly and precisely what's available at these establishments, from the hours, the food, the entertainment, the specials, you name it. And I think we did pretty good at it. as far as the jokes go, that was probably the hardest part of the book. Kevin had this idea. He wanted to hear the funniest joke ever told in each bar. So the first bar we go to, he has his professional reporter tape recorder out, and there's a line of customers waiting to tell their funny jokes, and I'm sitting there after about a half an hour. I'm just shaking my head. I'm thinking, there's not one of these jokes we could dare print. So we had to sometimes go outside the establishment for a funny joke. One of the better ones that I like is, hey, Lester, how do you get an Ohio State graduate off your property?
I don't know. How you do that?
You pay him for the pizza.
Well, the U of M folks here will love that one, I'm sure. So this was essentially a 8-month-long road trip. Any favorite stories gathered along the way, mishaps that, you know, would be suitable for the radio?
We spent a lot of time driving back to the Sioux at 5 in the morning on a Saturday or Sunday morning and saw thousands of animals by the road. Moose, wolves, coyotes, bear, deer, and didn't hit one of them. So that was kind of a mishap that never happened. And then the other thing we really got a kick out of is just the stories we heard. We found out that where the hula hoop was invented, there's a bar just south of Paradise called the Silver Creek Pub. And we went over there because we heard they had a hula hoop happy hour. Well, Lester, picture this. It's 4 o'clock. You get a drink special. You go over the rack, pick out your favorite hula hoop, and head to the dance floor and start hula hooping while you're drinking your
I don't think anybody wants to picture that. Not with me, well, anyway. I'm glad you guys try it.
No, we were too busy photographing the action. But this old timer came up to me, waved a crook finger in my face, and says, "Young man, I know you think this is all funny, but the hula hoop was invented right here on this property." I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, I got out my notebook. I says, "Tell me about it." He says, "It's 1925, and we're in the throes of Prohibition. Barrels of the illegal Canadian bootleg whiskey mysteriously found their way over to the area. Now, after the contents of those barrels were drained by the locals, and the wood was used to heat the Upper homes during our long, harsh Upper winters, all that was left was the metal staves or rings. So some entrepreneurs started selling them at a nickel a whack so we could stay fit and limber during the winter."
Well, I don't know if that's where Hasbro got the idea, but it's a good story anyway. So the book's been out for a little while. Any kind of reactions going on? Anything follow-up because of the book?
We're getting a lot of positive response. One of the real ironic things on this book is it's Thanksgiving and a producer from a production company in New York City that does reality TV shows is visiting a relative in Ann Arbor. Happens to go in Barnes & Noble, gets his hands on a copy of the book. Long story short, they were up here in February filming, and their expectation is to do a reality TV show called Uperland. And there really is enough up here to support a show, from Mackinac Island to the Locks, to just the overall ambiance, and we're pretty excited about that. We should know in about a month if that's going to happen or not, and very ironic how that came about.
We'll have to keep an eye out for that one. Randy Kluck is researcher emeritus. Kevin Kluck, author and entrepreneur. They researched and wrote the travel guide Uper Bars. Thanks, guys, for joining us.
Hey, our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
So looking at that Uper Bars travel guide reminded me of a trip I took up in the UP just a few years ago. You can see the St. Mary's River, which connects Lake Superior to Lake Huron, from the front door of the Antlers in Sault Ste. Marie. It's late afternoon, and the place is already packed. Walt Kinney's father bought this bar and restaurant after getting fed up with working on the police force in Detroit back in the late 1940s. But Kinney says when his father took over, he had to bring a little law and order to the place.
At that time, it was a rough and tumble place, and before they got it, it was known as the Bucket of Blood, so that explains it right there, right?
When Kinney's father bought the business, it was already named the Antlers, and today, walking in, the name seems a fitting one. There are hundreds of stuffed deer heads and moose and antelope with horns and antlers hanging everywhere. There are geese and ducks and fish of every description mounted to the walls, hanging from the rafters, stuffed in every nook and cranny. All right, that's still selling this place a little short. It's not your run-of-the-mill taxidermy here. There's a polar bear, a pair of lions, a 20-foot anaconda. I mean,
sheesh, there's a two-headed calf standing next to the bar. Walt Kinney says when his father bought the business, though, it had barely earned its name.
And they got a moose or something, threw it up and said, let's call it the Antlers, you know. And so then I just kept taking what I wanted out of the collections I'd buy. So this is how it ended up, and I don't really have they're just up. That's the way it is. There's no plan here.
But somehow, all the antler chandeliers and dead animals, fish, and fowl kind of works, if you're okay with dead animals staring blankly at you while you eat your food.
I've had a couple of people walk in and say, oh, my goodness, I'm not going to eat here. Well, you know, they don't like it, but not very many.
Now, I heard about antlers from a guy down in Lansing who said his big thing about antlers was the ship whistle. What's he talking about?
Well, when this first started, they had a big bell, the school bell up there. It's still up there. And when somebody brought around with a construction dredge guys, they'd ring that bell. Well, when they added some boat whistles in here and some stuff like that, and then when somebody came in from a distance, they'd ring the bells, and, you know, it just started going. And now I've added to them again, and now we just blow them every half hour if the crowd gets quiet to wake them up a little bit or whatever, you know.
Well, what are the chances I can hear what this is all about?
We'll do it for you right now.
Okay? Sounds good. It's pretty good. That's a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, I like it. You know, it's noisy. I have a set of air horns buried up in that beam right there, but they broke and I never fixed them. They were really loud. They were too loud.
The Antlers in Sault Ste. Marie. Come for the taxidermy, stay for all the bells and whistles.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. When the legislature and the governor cut a portion of the earned income tax, that's the tax break for the working poor, it was argued at the time that it was already just a piggyback on the federal earned income tax credit. It wasn't that necessary. A state couldn't afford it anymore. So it was cut from the rate of 20% of the federal credit to just 6% of the federal credit. So many of the working poor saw taxes increase. On top of that, some other tax changes have meant even more tax increases on some of Michigan's struggling families. Well, legislation to restore the state earned income tax credit has been introduced, and the Michigan League for Public Policy is supporting it. Gilda Jacobs is the president of that group and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
The proponents of cutting the EITC back in 2011 said this just isn't going to make that much difference because you've got this federal one. So kind of give me an example of what kind of money are we talking about, and, you know, how would it help if you're, you know, one disaster away from welfare?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's go back, because I really think that the reasoning that they're already getting the federal EITC is really not what was going on. You have to remember that the reduction of the earned income tax credit was really part of tax reform in Michigan, where business taxes were cut by 70-80% in the state, and they had to make up part of this this hole, and part of making up the benefits to businesses were really going back and going and balancing the budget on the backs of low income people. So I don't buy that argument that this was done because we didn't have the money. We didn't have the money because we gave all sorts of tax breaks to the business world. So, you know, I just have to kind of really put that out there. But for low-wage workers, these benefits go to families that are making between, you know, $10,000 and $22,000, not a lot of money. And the
so in dollar amount, what was the average cost to them?
You know, so we're maybe talking average about $300 per filer. Now, $300 is something that for families who are living on the edge means a lot. If they need to catch up on their rent or make a car repair so that they can get to work, those kinds of dollars are huge. And yes, do they need the federal earned income tax credit? Yep, they need that. But this is something that actually looks at the amount of taxes that people that are low income pay anyways. They pay property taxes through their rent. They're paying taxes on clothing that they purchase, any other purchases. And if you look at the actual burden on a family, a low-income family, there's a greater tax burden on a low-income, low-wage worker than there is on a middle or upper-income individual.
Your organization recently stated that Michigan's tax system is growing more regressive as a result of the changes in 2011. Can you explain that just a little further?
Well, again, if, you know, the regressivity pops up when you compare who gets hurt most in the tax system. And as I said, if a low-income person is paying a greater percentage of their income on taxes, that is a very regressive system. You know, to me, if you make more money, you should be paying more taxes than somebody that is paying that's earning $15,000 a year. It's almost intuitive, besides the fact that it's fairer.
What kind of difference are we seeing between working poor families and those who are much wealthier in the rate of taxes?
Well, you know, again, the tax rate hurts low and middle income people greater than it does for people in the higher income brackets. So you're going to have a larger impact. You know, this is not the average $300 is not money that, you know, this family is going to put away to take, you know, their family on a cruise. And when, you know, you look at the fact that we have still almost 9% unemployment in our state, you know, over 8%, people are still hurting. Now, yeah, the economy is getting better. But for people at the, you know, at the lower end of the scale right now, they're not really seeing those same kinds of differences in terms of their ability to make ends meet. And they are living from paycheck to paycheck if they're when they're working.
I noticed the legislation to restore the EITC, the state EITC, is sponsored by two Democrats. Considering the Republicans hold large majorities in the House and Senate and that cutting the EITC was the governor's idea to begin with, and he'll have veto power over it, what are the chances of actually restoring the state earned income tax credit to 20% of federal EITC as it was before?
Well, I think there's a couple of scenarios that could play out. First of all, the governor actually at a conference that I attended a number of months ago really did indicate that the EITC was a wonderful anti-poverty tool. So he really does believe in the concept of an earned income tax credit. But I think as things move forward in this whole budget dance, where there are lots of things that the governor and the Republicans would like that may cause some heartburn in the Republican caucuses, where they're going to need to go over to the other side of the aisle and try to get some Democratic support. Hopefully, the earned income tax credit might be part of the negotiations moving forward. You know, we've actually heard Republican legislators speak publicly about the fact that perhaps the EITC can be one of the negotiations in terms of road funding. So even though this was not put in the budget right now, and, you know, and you have to understand, even historically, when this was originally slated to have been eliminated totally from the governor's very first budget, negotiations happen, things change, and all of a sudden, the EITC was saved from the hangman. And the idea now is when you have an opportunity, when things get better in the state, when you want to try to create some fairness, that can go in and be part of negotiations moving forward. So I think that there is a very good chance that at least there will be partial restoration of the earned income tax credit. You know, it's only each percentage point that they increase the EITC only costs $18 million. And when I say only $18 million, when you have a multi-billion dollar budget, we're not talking about really a lot of dollars to the state's coffers, but it really makes a huge difference to the individual who was receiving that earned income tax credit.
And your group makes the point that those dollars are going to be spent not on cruises, as you were mentioning, or going out of state, but they're going to be spent on groceries and clothes, stuff that's bought right here in Michigan.
Yeah, and also, Lester, it lifts the kids that live in these families, helps to lift them out of poverty. And anything that we can do to lift kids out of poverty is something that we ought to be doing. In fact, it continues to be something on the governor's dashboard, which is trying to lift kids out of poverty in the state. That's, unfortunately, one of the areas where the needle did not move, where we did not see any positive growth over the last year. So So I think that if, you know, if we're really serious about wanting to have economic opportunity for all people in the state, this is certainly one way that we can do that.
I think there's a certain amount of irony in the fact that the federal EITC originally came about because of a Republican from Michigan, some guy named Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford, absolutely. And Ronald Reagan, you know, said, oh, this is the greatest anti-poverty tool that there is. But, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, this is the point that needs to be, you know, reinforced is that this is a credit for people that are working. You only get this if you're working. So it's a terrific incentive to also help bridge people to the point where they're not going to need to have it later on.
Gilda Jacobs is the president and CEO of Michigan League for Public Policy. Thanks very much for joining us and explaining
sure, thanks,
the
thanks,
EITC.
I know.
During the last session of the Michigan legislature, there was an attempt to change the state's auto no-fault insurance with claims that it would lower rates. This is something the auto insurance industry keeps lobbying for. It did not pass last time, and Governor Rick Snyder said in his State of the State address, we do need to keep costs down.
In terms of no-fault, in terms of claims coming in, the severity of claims, we far exceed every other state in how expensive our claims are. The average claim in Michigan is $44,000. The other next two states are $17,000 and $10,000. And that leads to high auto insurance costs for people, our citizens, our customers. And we have three of the top 10 most expensive states in the nation for auto insurance. We have Detroit at number one, we have Novi at number six, and we have Muskegon at number nine. It's time for some reforms, folks. And the two reforms I'm talking about is, first, we should reform no fault. It is time to do that in a thoughtful way.
But there's little evidence that your insurance rates would go down that much or at all by putting limitations on no fault. That's because the real reason auto insurance is so high in some areas is theft, fraud, and uninsured motorists. The part of no fault that guarantees someone severely hurt will get the reasonable care they need is just a fraction of the cost, and some would argue the best bargain in the nation. Joining me now is a lawyer who, we should point out, fights these insurance companies over claims on a regular basis. Stephen Gersten is with the law firm Michigan Auto Law. All right, Stephen, so most of us find auto insurance coverage a little confusing at best. So let's start explaining some things. What is catastrophic coverage, and what is the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association?
Sure. So what happens is anytime a claim it is $500,000 or more, it gets shifted from the private insurer, your no-fault insurance company, to this collection of insurance companies called the MCCA. And they then pay the claim from $500,000 ongoing.
So that's the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association. We've got new legislation from Virgil Smith who wants to change no fault. It's similar to what we've seen in the past. I've heard a lot of people talking about limiting these payouts, capping them, and that would solve the problem of Michigan's high auto insurance rates. Will it?
No, it won't.
Why not?
And that's what's so frustrating about this is it makes no sense. Let's start with the proposition that everyone agrees on, which is we currently have the best insurance system in the United States as far as care and the quality of care for an individual. But what the proponents of no-fault reform say is that by somehow capping medical care at, for example, Virgil Smith wants to do it at $50,000, that's going to lower people's auto insurance rates. But you know what? The insurance companies aren't saying that. And what it does is what we're doing is we're shifting the burden of paying these expensive claims to the rest of us as taxpayers.
Or from auto insurers to health insurers.
Well, and also to us as taxpayers. Because what happens is if you're capped at $50,000 in no fault, then these people are going to have to be basically pushed onto things like Medicaid and Medicare to pay the cost of these medical bills for these catastrophic claims, or really in Virgil Smith's case, again, any claim that's over $50,000. And if you're in a serious auto accident, that's basically an emergency room.
Now, I've covered this issue in the past, and I talked to several people whose costs were in excess of $1 million, $1.3, $1.4 million. So we're talking about $50,000 versus the real cost that could run well into $1 million.
The real problem with Virgil Smith's plan is what all it's going to do is really create tens of thousands of very small, completely unnecessary lawsuits, because people are going to have to sue now the person who caused the auto accident for everything over the cap. But the bigger frustration for me is this, is that if there was some argument that the insurance companies were losing money in Michigan, all right, we can then at least engage in a debate about whether it's better that the burden be shifted to us as taxpayers, or if it should continue being paid by the auto insurance companies that charge a premium. But, you know, there's a reason why Warren Buffett, you know, the greatest investor of all time, buys insurance companies. And in Michigan, they are extremely profitable. So what we're doing is we're talking about making them more profitable, lowering the quality of care, and shifting the cost to us.
Now, the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, which is made up of representatives of the insurance industry, says that it's going broke. It's not sustainable. We have to change things. But for the life of this group, it's never revealed how it makes its assessments. And a judge ruled last year, you got to open your books. Has that happened right yet? Has anyone been able to determine whether the MCCA is healthy or not?
No. You know, the MCCA, which we fund as drivers and, again, as taxpayers, actually operates in greater secrecy than the Central Intelligence Agency, and that doesn't make a lot of sense. And what you have with the MCCA is a critical flaw in its design. You really have a situation where the fox is guarding the hen house, where you have a board made up of insurance companies, made up of executives from the insurance industry, who are deciding what rates are, but on the other hand, they won't disclose the basis, the information that they are using, and especially their assumptions about claims coming in and what they'll have to pay going out to us.
So if this is not really going to lower our insurance rates to any great extent, if at all, why does this legislation keep popping back up?
Well, you know, part of this is, I believe, a result of Citizens United and just the amounts of money that the insurance industry can funnel into politics today. And you have a situation in Michigan where I think they see a tremendous opportunity where you've got all three branches of government in Republican hands, and traditionally the Republicans have been the main beneficiaries of, you know, these donations, these campaign contributions by the industry. So I think that's sadly one reason why a governor's CPA isn't asking to look at the numbers before he's looking to make these really dramatic changes to a system that's worked very, very well in Michigan for 40 years.
We should note that Virgil Smith is a Democrat and not a Republican, and he's the sponsor of this legislation.
Virgil's been alone among all the Democrats in pushing these reforms. And, you know, the problem is his constituency is the one that would really get hammered the hardest by this. And I guess my biggest frustration with all this is Michigan is not, we can have it both ways. We can keep the best insurance system in the country intact, and we could really lower rates dramatically for everybody very quickly if we wanted to. And all we need to do is adopt the same exact system that exists in most other states, where we can give our insurance commissioner the real power to look at these rates and to say, you know what, Allstate or AAA or State Farm, you don't need to make over 20% in profit margins selling a product that people in Michigan are legally required to buy, which is no-fault insurance. That maybe we think 10 or 15% is more reasonable. That would lower rates for people overnight, and that's not ever being discussed.
Stephen Gersten is with Michigan Auto Law, and I want to note that he's the author of a recent guest column in Bridge Magazine entitled 8 Steps That Will Lower Auto Insurance Rates. Mr. Gersten, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.